Hello and welcome to the Weatherby Resources fourth quarter podcast. I think about fourth quarter and I can't believe we're already here and we've done four of these this year. And our hope is that it has been really meaningful information for you guys, that it will help you run your business and do the ministry of hospice a whole lot better nationwide. And so today we have another informational session that I think will help you understand a little bit more about the opioid epidemic and how it has weaved into the hospice world. And so we have Dr. Clevis Parker with us today, and he is an extremely well-respected and established physician executive. He has over 17 years of leadership experience. He has demonstrated proven outcomes in quality improvement, also in workflow and process improvement. He's done all of this by utilizing what probably many of you are familiar with as the Lean principles. He has demonstrated program development, but he's not only developed things, he has implemented them as well. And he has a lot of hospice and palliative care, regulatory and compliance experience and expertise. So Dr. Parker, welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. And my gosh, that sounds like somebody I'd love to know.
That's sometimes what I think whenever people are introducing. When people always say, how do you want us to introduce you? And I'm just like, just say it's Melanie Hill. And that's enough.
Exactly.
So I'm not too big on introductions. But thank you again for joining us. And I just want to start out with, just so for my education, but certainly for the folks that are going to be listening to our podcast, just tell me a little bit of the overall picture of the opioid epidemic today.
Sure. You know, it's certainly something that's been a challenge for the country. And in fact, you know, they've called it an opioid epidemic, so a national public health emergency. So maybe just start with a little bit of fact finding here a little bit. So the number of opioid prescriptions have increased over the last few years. So we had 76 million prescriptions written in 91. And up until 2011, which is the last data they had available, we've had an increase to 219 million prescriptions for opioids. So not only did the prescription volume increase, but so did the outcomes of death. So, you know, looking back at some of the data, it looks like 2015, we had a little over 52,000 deaths from opioid overdoses. And then you go to 2016, we had a little over 64,000 deaths. And now in 2017, there was over 72,000 deaths. And it's considered now the leading cause of death in people under the age of 50. 2018 data suggests that approximately 115 people are dying a day. So if you could only imagine, this has certainly taken a hold of the opioid industry and prescribers in general. So I think, you know, in addition to some of those facts, now it's got to be what's practical for us. And, you know, kind of talking a little bit about how did we even get here? I think that's important to know. So it started, I would say, probably in the 80s. There was an editorial letter sent to the New England Journal of Medicine that talked about addiction in patients who were taking opioids and said, hey, when patients are taking opioids, there's a very little risk of addiction. Well, I think we know that's not true.
Right. So exactly.
Development of long-acting opioids occurred in the 1980s and 90s. So, you know, those who are getting these intermittent or immediately release opioid medications, it was easier for patients and prescribers to start prescribing the longer-acting versions because they didn't have to take so many. Aggressive marketing from the pharmaceutical industry kind of played a role in that. As you can tell, the outcome of that now is all these lawsuits that are being settled. Even just today, you had a major lawsuit settled for $260 million from four pharmaceutical companies, right?
Honestly, I just popped up my iPad because I remembered seeing that yesterday, I think, and I was going to pull it back up so I had my facts right, but I saw that yesterday. That's huge.
Yeah, so that was the one most recent, but right before that, you had Purdue Pharma settling. So, you know, it's an unfortunate event that's transpired in our country where you've had aggressive marketing by these pharmaceutical companies, and unfortunately, we've not addressed the outcome until now. You know, now President Trump and everybody else is on board saying, okay, what do we need to do? Even the CDC is making concessions and making recommendations.
Right.
But I think I've even seen his.
Yeah, I think I've even seen his wife has got it. President Trump's wife Melania has gotten very involved, hasn't she?
Yeah, she has. I mean, I think it's going to take as many people as possible to start addressing some of these needs, especially when you talk about the regulatory requirements that are going to be needed. But again, I think if you look at it, so that's from the pharmaceutical side. But what about from our side?
Exactly.
Not just the New England Journal of Medicine saying, you know, from an editorial piece that, you know, addiction and opioids are not going together. We know that's not true. But even from the Joint Commission standpoint, right, included that as a fifth vital sign in the 1990s. They were saying, hey, providers, you need to start addressing pain more aggressively. And so we did. So, you know, and now we're trying to walk that backwards and say, well, maybe we're a little bit too aggressive in evaluating patients' pain.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just things have changed. I, you know, whenever you and I were discussing all of this on the telephone the other day, I've been in the hospice industry for almost 24 years, and just the whole perspective of pain management has changed. And much of it is due to this. I mean, we still are the industry that I think is intent on helping with pain and symptom management. But because of this, things have just changed so much.
Yeah, they really have. You know, we've kind of always been a little bit diligent about opioids and prescribing in our industry. You know, we certainly had some leakage and some room for opportunity, and I think that's been addressed somewhat by the law that was just recently passed. But I think, you know, all in all, hospice agencies have done a fairly good job of trying to at least self-regulate opioid prescriptions, you know, and paying attention to people that may have diversion issues.
Right. So what are some of the techniques that you have seen that are successful that hospices can employ to address the opioid diversion?
Sure. From a hospice standpoint, we've been doing this for a while. You know, sometimes we use lock boxes when we identify that there may be some misuse, as well as people that are not necessarily using the appropriate medications that we're prescribing, or those who may have family members who may have access and the opportunity for misuse. So lock boxes has been something that we've done. We've also learned to prescribe smaller quantities. So instead of getting, you know, the 1 month supply that you used to do back in the day, it then kind of shrunk down to 14-15 day supply. And when we find that there's someone who may have a misuse or abuse or diversion potential, we go down to maybe 3 days.
Gotcha.
And lastly, but certainly not all inclusive, is sometimes we remove patients from the environment they're in,
right,
and put them in a safer environment. So those are some of the things that we were doing in the past to try to eliminate or at least pay attention to those who were diverting.
Right. So, I mean, I think what's typical and what one of the things that we have to be cautious about in this industry is not so much from the patient perspective, but unfortunately from the family and or friends and the people that are around them taking the drugs. Is that still a true statement?
Yeah, and I think that's probably the biggest issue for us, right? Most hospice patients are not doctor shopping.
Right.
You know, not like, you know, those who might have gotten hooked on opioids from chronic pain management. These are patients who are in their last days or last months who truly need pain relief. And
right.
In fact, you know, a study suggests that up to 80% of hospice patients will experience pain towards the end of death, especially towards the time when they're truly dying, actively dying. So that's something that we've always addressed from that standpoint, but the families are the issue. So the new law that was passed kind of empowers hospices to kind of take a hold of some of that leakage, take advantage of the opportunity to maybe destroy some of those medications. So we'll see how that pans out, but
yeah.
The legislation now certainly provides us with the opportunity to even cut off some of those misuse and abuse potentials from diversion from family members.
Gotcha. So tell me some of the challenges that have been experienced in hospice since some of the regulations have been enacted to hopefully it's going to end up addressing this crisis.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a great question. from the hospice standpoint, has not really been all that helpful. I think the new law that was enacted, that's certainly piece of the puzzle that needs to be solved. But that's really not addressing some of the opioid laws and challenges that we're facing now. In fact, I think I read recently there was up to 27, 28 states that implemented policies that would limit opioid prescriptions. Some of those limitations have not excluded hospice or palliative care services. So some of the stringent regulations that they have applied, like checking a PMP, which I don't think is unreasonable, but I do think, which is your prescription pharmacy monitoring program, what I do think is unreasonable is if every time you prescribe an opioid in hospice or change an opioid for the same patient, either from an opioid to another or even a dose, that you'd have to actually check the PMP. That's a challenge. So that's one of the barriers.
Yeah.
The other one is there are some laws that require what they call a bona fide relationship. Well, we're kind of regulated already in the hospice industry by the federal government. So a nurse is an extension of our services. Hospices have been nurse, led for a long time, and we rely on them as part of the interdisciplinary team to kind of be our eyes and ears on the ground. And so a bona fide relationship, it's required that a prescriber is going to actually have to go and make a visit to the patient prior to prescribing. Well, that's going to be a barrier to providing good pain relief for our hospice patients. And there are more and more things that have been said, or at least laws that have been enacted that kind of provide some barriers. But all in all, I think there are certain states that are now really trying to work that backwards. This state that I'm practicing in currently now, Nevada, that was one. Initially, this law was really, really tight. It, it pretty much told you could only prescribe acute pain is 14 days. You needed a contract first with the patient. You needed them to sign off on all these things. And then each time you prescribe something different, you had to check the PMP. And every single provider that was in your organization needed to go and have a contract, opioid prescribing contract with that patient. So if I was on call in the middle of the night, got a call, I couldn't prescribe an opioid.
Right.
Unless I went out and saw the patient, because to establish a bona fide relationship, and then, get a contract signed that says we can prescribe. So that's now been changed in this state to exclude hospice, palliative care, and cancer patients. And so I think more and more states are going to start to have to look at reworking some of these stringent laws.
Yeah. So tell me, okay, you've referred to a couple of times that the law that was passed. Tell me, for my information, I know just enough to be dangerous, probably, but for everybody else's information, just so we're all on the same page, tell us what that law enacted.
Sure. The law, let's see, it talked about hospice providers being able to destroy medications or given in certain instances where that might be true for them to do so. We have to still get permission from the family. Yeah. But what it suggests is if someone dies, then we have the right to actually ask the patient's family, hey, we'd like to destroy the medications. The other scenario we could destroy is if we've had a change in a narcotic and it's no longer helpful. And the last one was if an opioid is expired, we have the right to at least ask the family to destroy the medications. Up until that point, we really didn't have that law or protection to do so. And I know that there have been some hospices in the past that might have done that, but they did that on their own without being protected. At least now we have some protection. It still didn't quite go as far as it could have gone, because the property belongs to the deceased family, so it goes to the estate. And so we still need that permission in order to destroy it. And if someone's going to divert, they're going to tell you, no, I don't want you to destroy that medication. You can leave it. I'll take care of that, right? So it still leaves an opportunity for diversion or misuse, but at least it gives us the opportunity to have the conversation.
Gotcha. So, if you are in front of a room of hospice professionals and they ask you, give us kind of one, I don't know, it's hard to narrow down to one. What's your best advice about the climate that we're in, as you know, to where opioid abuse and the crisis and everything has to do with hospice? What's your best advice on what we need to be doing, what we need to be looking for, anything like that, kind of as we close? Just give them your best.
I think maybe answering that question with a couple of different points. I think we need to start understanding opioid addiction. That's something that we don't necessarily get trained on. So incorporating that even in fellowship programs, learning about substance use disorder, I think that's certainly going to help us understand the potential for abuse. Sometimes I think we don't catch it because we just don't pay attention to it, or don't see it. It's not on top of the mind. So understanding that is going to be important. I think the other part of that is making sure that we have a good program in place for those who may have addiction issues. So that way we're paying real close attention to those families and patients and providing that support. Right. But learning as much as you can about misuse, diversion, and mental health and how that plays a role. They coexist, and some people use opioids for coping. I think that's going to be the key to success in combating the opioid diversion and opioid crisis in our world.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today and giving a lot of valuable, again, use the word meaningful information, because I know it will be very, it's just good for everybody to know more about. Sometimes the more we can talk about things and the more that we can hear other people's opinion and their facts and the things that you know because of your depth in this category, it's just better. It's better for everybody. So, Dr. Parker, we appreciate your time today, and thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate the opportunity. Have a great day.
Yes, you too. And everyone, we will be back in January. I know that we can't, it's almost Christmas, right? And we can't believe that we're talking about this time of year, but all the Christmas displays are up at Lowe's and Walmart and all the places that I've seen lately. So we are talking about this time of year. But we will be back in January with another, I think, a good, meaningful podcast and some information that you'll want to hear. So thank you for joining us this year in 2019, and we look forward to more good information for you and reaching out to you guys in 2020. Thank you so much.